we should be looking for a doctor or a hospital who saw this child prior to the injury that nearly fatally abused him.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know why you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this windy channel.
This is Missing Magnolias, Scarlett and Michelle here, and we have a great guest with us today. We have someone who was key in not only helping break the chain of silence on reporting child abuse, but who was acutely instrumental in changing the legal framework so as to offer victims a better outcome when abuse is reported by professionals. With us today, we have Lon Isaacson here to discuss how, as a then law student and clerk, his 1975 law article would go not only to make its way to the California state courts, but would aid a high-profile Los Angeles case of child abuse known in the press as Baby Robeson. Lon's legal analysis into child abuse would become informative later in his career as well, when he has sued Los Angeles Catholic Diocese and was awarded $12 million on behalf of the victims who had experienced abuse by the clergy as children. Lon's legal expertise is actually in tax fraud, but his career would never be boring. And hopefully today there's an organized crime story or two to throw in for good measure. Welcome, Lon.
Well, thank you for having me, Scarlett and Michelle. You might note that the case you referred to against the Archdiocese, which resulted in June 2007, compelling Cardinal Mahoney to come up from $50 million on behalf of 507 remaining victims to pay the then staggering sum of $660.11 million. And what's so significant about the fact that the Archdiocese of Los Angeles paid that sum is that Cardinal Mahoney found himself so burdened by his own gross misconduct over decades and by the misconduct of so many that worked under him that he settled the case in June 2007 and allowed us to take a judgment against the Archdiocese in the amount of $660.11 million when he didn't have, at that moment, the funds to pay the judgment. And I can tell you from a law career that even though it ended more than a decade ago and lasted 37 years, I'd never encountered a litigant that was willing to become a judgment debtor and didn't have the funds to pay the judgment voluntarily. And that goes to show you how scared he was based upon his gross misconduct that we had uncovered after a gargantuan, laborious investigation that sent investigators all throughout the state of California and up into the hinterlands of Northern California, where the church maintains in partnership with a sect called the Paraclete, some 50,000 barren acres of land. When I say barren, I mean barren. No addresses, no telephones, virtually no way to locate anybody on this 50,000 acre plot of raw land where the church traditionally sent each and every person affiliated with the church that had the slightest taint. As soon as the slightest taint reached the ears of executives of the church, I call them executives because I regard the church as a business. So the priests, bishops, archbishops, cardinal, they're the executives of the church. And as soon as they got wind of the slightest complaint of child abuse, they would whisk the accused into this hinterland. And of course, they were completely unavailable to anybody who would want to question them indefinitely. Imagine when the police would come around some months after an accusation would be hurled at the church that, in our case, Priest Celestine had committed child abuse, and the police came to the office of the cardinal and asked to be connected to Priest Celestine. And he was told, the policeman was told, well, we would like to do that, but unfortunately, Father Celestine is in deep monastic retreat. Policeman say, okay, so what? Give me his address. Well, we don't have his address. Where is he? Well, he can call the office of the sect of the Paraclete up in Northern California, and they perhaps they can find him. And the policeman would call the sect, and they wouldn't answer the phone. And, you know, if the policeman did bother to go up there, and I don't know of any case where they did, how are they going to find him? 50,000 acres, no addresses, no phones. And this was their one of their tactics. But I'm getting ahead of the story. Basically, you alluded to how this all began. It's a very interesting genesis.
You mentioned pre-show battered child syndrome. Can you first kind of tell us a little bit about what that is?
The battered child syndrome, it was a term that was coined by Professor Kempt, who was a psychology and sociology professor. And he had an interest in understanding child abuse and understanding its effect on society. We have to step back because we have to realize when a child is abused, it's kind of like throwing a rock in a pond. There's enormous ripples that extend out. Not only do we have our medical system taxed and our hospital system taxed, but we have the basic fundamental block of society, which is the family, at risk of fracture, certainly stressed. And then the most important thing is we have that poor child, as you mentioned early in this broadcast, scarred and sometimes often scarred for life. And studies have shown that habitual criminals are often, not always, but often victims of horrific, repeated child abuse. So there is a linkage between child abuse and a lifetime of criminality. But the Baby Robeson case, which I encountered in the early 1970s, it came about in an odd way. Baby Robeson was the offspring of a father who was not of high moral character and kind of left the family early, and a mother who was not of high moral character and became involved with Hell's Angels type people. And this poor child was obviously not in a loving environment and was subject to various kinds of abuse. As we all know, if we have any interaction with kids, they're rambunctious. They're energetic. In fact, we envy their energy. We envy their extraordinary stamina. They run everywhere. We wish we could keep running. But, you know, unfortunately, Father Time slows us down. But they have virtually no blockage between themselves and whatever it is they want to do. And they have enthusiasm and energy. And poor Baby Robeson probably had an excess of that enthusiasm and energy. And he found himself battered, just as Dr. Kemp called it. And I was working at the time for a very well-regarded insurance defense firm. That was one of many jobs I had during law school. I had always at least two law firms I worked for, sometimes as many as three. So I was working many days through the night working for two brilliant trial lawyers. And both of these bright trial lawyers had me working for them night and day on the mountain of paperwork that it takes to conduct a civil law practice. There was many a day I worked through the night. In fact, I had a little area of their lunchroom where I brought a sleeping bag and turned a couch around. And that was my little place where I took an hour's nap or two, you know, when I had to work through the night. Thursday or Friday, Mr. Lawler called me and he said, "Lon, would you please come in on Saturday? We're having a meeting. It's a very important meeting at the law firm, and I'd really like you to be there." I said, "Byron, I work like a dog during the week. I don't want to come in on Saturday. I want to play tennis. Saturday's my fun day." He said, "Lon, I don't ask you to do too many things. This is really important." He said, "The head of the firm, Mr. Stockdale is calling a meeting of the top eight partners in the firm. There's a very important case that he wants us all to discuss, a very difficult case. And I'd like you to come in and just sit in the corner with your notepad taking notes." I said, "Okay, Byron." And very reluctantly, I came in at 9 o'clock in the morning on next Saturday, sat in the corner, and I listened to eight lawyers with anywhere from 15 to 35 years experience, absolutely not know the first thing what to do with this case. For 2 hours, we got nothing done. There was not one idea, nothing said that made any sense. And I just listened and I thought, what a waste of time. And as I was walking out, Mr. Lawler introduced me to Mr. Stockdale. I'd never met him before. I blurted out, I said, obviously, the only thing we can do here is we have to look for a source of money. Well, what had happened is Baby Robeson had been abused seriously and had ended up in the hospital, and he was severely disabled. And they had whisked him off to a neuro institute in Colorado. I don't remember the name of it, where he was being treated and stabilized. But the costs were about $15,000 a month. It doesn't seem like a lot today, but back in the early 70s, that was a very large sum of money. Mr. Stockdale had relationships with some of the doctors in that institution, and somehow he arranged for this child to be admitted. But they had to find a way to pay these massive accruing medical bills and take care of this child. And they couldn't even conceive of a way. I mean, after all, we knew the child was battered by either the mother or the boyfriend or somebody. And what were we going to do? Repossess their motorcycle? I mean, we're looking for money. There's, you know, nobody had an idea. So I blurted out to Mr. Stockdale as we were leaving. I was introduced to him. You know, we have to look for money. So Stockdale says to Lawler, "Who's this guy?" And then Lawler describes me what I'm doing. Stockdale says to me, "Well, do you have any ideas?" I said, "Well, I have some semblance of some ideas, but I don't want to tell you I have any ideas yet. I want to do some study and reading and thinking about this." So in a moment's time, my life was changed because Stockdale pulled me away from Lawler and Ramsey, and he had me working about half time or more just on this case. And my assignment was just to read as widely as I needed to and wanted to, and to report to him every week to 10 days on how my ideas were evolving. And the reality is that I had an enviable opportunity. At the expense of the law firm, which was supporting me, I was able to negotiate a 50% raise in my base pay. Doesn't sound like much. It went from, I think, $12 to $18 an hour, but it was a lot
in 1970s.
Money.
Yeah.
Well, my rent was $65 a month,
which is crazy. That's crazy to even imagine. Yeah. Middle of Los Angeles.
$65 a month for a one bedroom apartment right across the street from Beverly Hills that was big enough to accommodate two men. And here I suddenly got to my pay raise from $12 to $18 an hour. I felt very secure.
I have to play the stupid person. So just to highlight how monumental this is, really. So, you know, in California, professionals, doctors, teachers, there's mandatory reporting, right? There's criminal or possible civil repercussions if they don't report.
Both. In fact, that law, the Allen Cologne Act, was passed in 1964, and it had a provision that required doctors, daycare workers, nurses, teachers, camp counselors, others that come in contact with children on a regular basis to report suspected cases of child abuse to social welfare agencies. And I was able, with Mr. Stockdale's permission, to do extensive research in the legislative history behind the act. The legislative history is all of the information that the legislature gets before they enact a statute. They take testimony from people, they do studies, they have committees that do studies. And that is usually available if you know where to look for it. It's a material that is in the public record. Sometimes it's not accessible as easily as you would like it to be, but it is there. And we learned from the legislative history of the Allen Cologne Act that the California legislature was very concerned about child abuse prior to 1964. Hospitals were reporting extensive incursions in their capital because of the expense they had to go to treat seriously injured children. Sociologists were reporting that there was disturbances in the children's education. We all know when people don't get educated adequately, they become less effective members of the workforce. So there was a tremendous concern in the legislature that led to the passage of this act. And one of the provisions of the act was that the people that were ordered to report, it wasn't voluntary. The act didn't say you may report. It said you shall report. You were ordered to report. Those people were excused from any civil liability if their report was incorrect, if they were negligent in the way they formulated the opinion that led them to report. There was virtually no blowback against a reporter, and the reporters were mandated to report. Unfortunately, the act initially didn't have any specific fine or any monetary penalty attached to a non-reporter. Now, what we found was that doctors did not routinely report. Why? Well, it's pretty logical. They didn't want to lose the patronage of their customers, the parents. They didn't want their time diluted by having to confer with social welfare agencies, police agencies, child abuse experts. I mean, a report would, you know, logically trigger an investigation, and the doctor would be the one that would be called upon to give fundamental information to the investigators, which takes him away from his practice. And I think that doctors found it very unpleasant to report because most of the findings are subtle findings. In other words, and I'll take the Baby Robeson case because that's a good example. If a child presents to a doctor and the child's ligaments in their shoulder are torn and stretched, the doctor is able to determine that from his diagnosis. He might take an x-ray. He can certainly palpate and feel the ligaments. He knows what the ligaments are supposed to feel like because that's part of his training. Now, he takes a history from the parents. How did Johnny suffer this injury? Now, this is, oh, well, you know, we take him to the park and, you know, there's a slide there and he slides down and he's a little rambunctious and he slid down the slide and he fell off the end onto his shoulder. Well, what does the doctor know when he gets a report like that? He knows the parent's a liar. Why? Because there's about 18 inches between the bottom of the slide and sand. He knows the sand is there to cushion the fall. And he knows you can't tear a child's ligament by that shallow fall at the end of a slide. Well, that should trigger the doctor to file a report of suspected cases of child abuse, because the doctor should suspect, knowing that typically a ligament stretch or tear is caused by a angry parent or an angry boyfriend slinging the child by their arms because they're angry, or some other type of an action that would actually tear the ligament, but they didn't report. And my idea that I was developing as I did more and more research was, if they didn't report, what should the consequences of their non-reporting be? And I was weighing in my mind continuously through this process of study and reading, well, the legislature did not put a fine in there to fine them. So they obviously didn't intend that a non-reporter is fined. So what should the penalty be? And the more and more I thought about it, I came back to the basic fundamental idea that the purpose of the statute was to protect society. You know, we have our foundation in society, and this isn't just America. This is throughout the world. Our foundation is children. Our foundation is so important. We have to devote a massive amount of our resources to educate, protect, nourish, give medical care, give dental care, give care for the family, care for emotional needs to children, to raise them with all the abnormalities that all of us are going to experience through our childhood. Because nobody goes through a childhood without some traumas and some difficulties and accidents and things that are stressful. We have to raise children to become highly productive members of society if we're going to progress. And when we chop down a child because we don't give him the care, when we abuse a child because we don't bring our institutions, our protective institutions, into play to protect and defend that child, we are weakening society. Now, it may not seem like a lot when you think of it in an individual case, but I wasn't thinking individually. I'm thinking in a global, universal way that every child is important and the aggregate is supremely important. So the more I thought about this question, and the question really was, what do we do to protect these children? It came back to the very thing I said to Mr. Stockdale at the end of that meeting, just blurting it out, finding the money. And so I thought about it and I said, who's got the money? Well, doctors have money. Insurance companies have money.
And this is to cover the child's injuries because you had no source of funds and they're quite large. He's going to have all of his life, right? And there's because the family didn't have the money. The guy, the father, the absent father didn't have the money.
Yes. Completely indigent. The person that we never found out with certainty who abused the child because the mother wouldn't come clean completely. But from interviewing the mother and other people in the environment, we believe it was the boyfriend, and we believe the child was just rambunctious and irritated the boyfriend, and the boyfriend beat the child. But what struck me, and this was the key point, is I said to myself, if we can find some responsibility by a doctor who failed to report, we might find some money.
And this child had seen multiple hospitals and doctors from the article. So,
yes.
Right.
So what we did was, after I formulated my idea, I went back to Mr. Stockdale and I said to him, this is not a complete legal theory and fully fleshed out, but my thinking is we should be looking for a doctor or a hospital who saw this child prior to the injury that nearly fatally abused him, saw him in the past when he'd been abused in the past. And of course, what gave me that idea was Professor Kemp's writings, because he coined the phrase battered child syndrome, because what he saw was one battery leads to another battery, leads to another battery. We don't find this as an isolated battery. We find this as a pattern of bad parenting over time. And so I said to Mr. Stockdale, my idea is let's put a pinpoint on the map where the abuse occurred. The apartment in San Luis Obispo, I believe that's where it was, where he was abused. And I said, let's draw a line out 20 miles and let's draw a circle around that line and let's find the pediatricians and hospitals within that radius, because that's where probably they had taken him if he had been abused prior to that. And let's just throw subpoenas at all these different entities. And we collected over 100 different entities from that idea. And sure enough, we did find a doctor who had previously seen the child. But in the course of my research and thinking, I thought, if that child who was previously abused had been reported to the welfare agencies, the police would have been brought into this. And then we found a case, and as you remember from the article, where the police were brought into it on a previous occasion. So we enlarged our defendants to a chief of police who had failed also to report. And we found every single person that we thought should have reported who didn't report, and we sued them. Now, the problem with that lawsuit was nobody had ever done that before. And in California, and I don't want to get too technical because it'll bore people, but in order to recover damages for a breach of the duty of care, which is another way of saying negligence, which is another way of saying not reporting, in order to recover damages, you have to have something called causation. Now, what is causation? Well, the word causation is like cause. There has to be a causal or direct connection between the non-reporting and the abuse that happens in the future. Well, what connection could there be? There's no connection. Why? Because the doctor didn't report on a Monday. How does the doctor know what's going to happen a month from now? How does the doctor know where the child will be, who the child will be with? How can the doctor be held responsible for a criminal violation, because battery of a child is a criminal violation, by somebody he couldn't possibly know who that might be, at a point in time he couldn't possibly know that it occurred, in a place he couldn't possibly know what that place is? So causation was completely missing. And that's the reason nobody had ever brought such a lawsuit before, because that key element to recover damages was missing. And that took a lot of thinking and a lot of study and a lot of, I guess I would say, mental gymnastics to some extent to overcome. But all of it was overcomable. I had done the research, I had done the study, and I prepared Mr. Lawler and Mr. Ramsey very well for the trial that came up sometime after that. And on the edge of the trial, I believe it was the Chubb Insurance Company or one other insurance company, they put up a $600,000 trust fund to take care of this child for the rest of his life. And We also wanted to make sure that the mother and the boyfriend didn't get any part of that money. So the way we set it up was that the fund would be a sinking fund available to pay the child's needs. And we knew the child didn't have a full lifespan. I don't remember how long the child lived, but it certainly wasn't a full lifespan. But we had a provision that the money would escheat back to the insurance company upon the child's death. So it was there to give the child what it needed to have the best life possible until the child expired, and then it would go back to the insurance company. And that is the first case of its kind that was ever resolved in California or anywhere. And it was so important that it received a significant article in the LA Times. And back in those days, the LA Times was not a newspaper of 20 pages. It was a very substantial newspaper comparable to the New York Times, the Milwaukee Journal, the Chicago Tribune. It was one of the nation's most important newspapers. The Chandler family did a great job as publishers of that newspaper. And Scarlett, you're a phenomenal researcher and a phenomenally effective investigator because you found that article.
I did. Yeah, I have to thank the Los Angeles Public Library. There's some really great researchers over there. It really takes a village. You know, they say it takes a village to raise children. We talk about frequently how people in society tend to fall through the cracks. And these are the early gatekeepers that can spot any kind of deviance or trouble ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, at least that's what we hope is happening. We think about those kiddos today. It's mostly our teachers that are seeing this kind of abuse going on as mandated reporters and reporting that. And that has been a safety net for so many children. I can't imagine a world where that didn't exist. And the whole time that you were talking, I was thinking about, I'm teaching a serial killer class this semester, and I was thinking about healthcare killers. When we talk about healthcare killers, we talk about how, when hospitals are suspicious of them, they tend to just move them around instead of formally reporting it to police agencies. They usually will ask them to leave with a letter of recommendation. And so because they don't want to be the hospital that has the healthcare killer, they don't want to be the hospital with the nurse that kills people. They don't want that reputation. So that tends to motivate these larger corporations of moving these offenders around when suspicions arise. And I imagine it would be so nice if there was a world where there would be repercussions for that. And it sounds really similar to how it was in the beginning with child abuse in that way, that people could just ignore these big, big issues. And there wasn't really a system to do anything about that until
really the wonderful thing about the Baby Robeson case, because having worked on it, I realized that it was important to change the law in California. And there's really only two ways to change the law. The first way that most people think of is, which is to get the legislature to write a new law, pass it, and get the governor to sign it. Well, all of us who know anything about politics in America know that the only people that have great access to legislatures are people that give them a lot of money. So if you're not giving them a lot of money, you're unlikely to get much of their attention, which is regrettable, but that is just the reality of our system. And then the other way to change the law, and the way I thought about changing it, is through the appeal courts, because the law in California in all states is basically written by the Court of Appeal and ultimately by the Supreme Court of the state. That's who writes the law. Is even if the legislature enacts a statute, it's interpreted, applied, and fleshed out by analysis by the Supreme Court or a Court of Appeal. If it's important enough, it goes to the Supreme Court. So I got to thinking about how do I get a Court of Appeal to change the law? And the only thing I could think of is to take everything I learned in the Baby Robeson case and to flesh it out. And I was a member of the law review at UCLA, so I fleshed it out as my student comment, which I had to write. I had to get published as part of my duties as a member of the law review. Well, I had some grave misfortune. I drew as my editor, Lowell Milken, and Lowell was only interested in two subjects, which was tax and constitutional law. Well, my analysis of child abuse didn't touch either of those subjects. So he used his power as a law review editor to reject my student comment on this subject. So I couldn't get it published in the UCLA Law Review. I was so upset by that because I knew the importance of this subject. So my student comment was in an inchoate state. But when I finished law school, rather than immediately plunge into practice and work, I devoted the better part of a year to completely rethinking the subject. And instead of writing a student comment, I wrote a major principal law review article. And I didn't submit it to UCLA. I knew it would never get published by them. But I wanted it to be published in California. And I submitted the article in the early part of 1975 to the San Diego Law Review. And they get about 300 submissions for two or three places on a law review. And why do they get so many? Because every law professor in America, to keep his job, has to publish articles, publish or perish. That's how it works. So it's very difficult to get a piece accepted for publication. But I was very fortunate. The editors read my piece, and within a month of it being submitted, I get a call, and the editor said, "Have you submitted it to anyone else?" I said, "No, I haven't. I'm going to submit it to somebody else. I was thinking of it this month. Please don't. We're going to publish it." And he said, "Not only are we going to publish it, it's going to be the lead article in our July edition," which is the edition that people seem to read the most because everybody's off. All the students are off and the professors are off. And it's our major issue, July. So I said, "You're going to publish it?" I was surprised and pleased. And they published it in July of 1975. And I was very, very fortunate because getting it published as the lead article in the major San Diego Law Review, it was brought to the attention of the Supreme Court of California in a case that came down in the next year, 1976. And that's the case of Landeros versus Flood. This is a case that's much like the Baby Robeson case. Now, remember, Baby Robeson settled. We didn't have a trial. They didn't go to trial because the insurance company put up that fund of $600,000. So we never really tried the case and tested these issues. But in the Landeros versus Flood case, they did go to trial and the doctor lost at trial. And then the Court of Appeal reversed the decision based on causation lacking, which is, remember, the issue that I was most worried about. But I had spent a great amount of time, and I know, Scarlett, that you, even though you're not a lawyer, but you're an extraordinarily attentive reader and analyst, I know you took the time to read the article, found it and read it, and read the causation materials there, you know, the arguments. And I can't tell you how pleased I was that a very short time after I started practicing law, one of the most famous justices in the United States, Justice Stanley Mast, he wrote the opinion in Landeros versus Flood, and he did me the supreme honor of calling me a commentator on the law and citing my article with approval for the arguments that I made, which changed the law exactly as I argued it should be changed, which is that we shouldn't be concentrating on causation in this case. We should be concentrating on what is the purpose of the law, the reporting law, and who is protected by it, and the consequences that should flow upon those that don't report, which is they should be held responsible when that child is reintroduced into what Dr. Kemp said is the battered child syndrome. We know it exists. We know he'll be reintroduced into it. And when he's injured, we can expect he'll be injured. And the doctor that didn't report, or the nurse, or the licensed daycare worker, or the camp counselor should be held civilly liable. And of course, what does that do when you hold somebody like that civilly liable? Everybody reports. In fact, today, I live with a woman who was a teacher for over two decades in an educational program, and everybody today, not only do they report, but they have classes. The hospitals give classes to their new classes of doctors that come in every year to work as interns and residents. They give classes on this to ensure they report. And the law in California, which was changed by the California Supreme Court, Justice Mast's opinion, Landeros versus Flood in 1976, is now universally the law across America. There's not a state that doesn't follow this law. We find that child abuse is something that is recognized as a great ill, and it has to be addressed. And as Scarlett pointed out, working on this law article as a law student, some 30 plus years, almost 40 years later, I found myself in the middle of one of the largest child abuse cases that's ever been handled, which is the case against the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. And that's not where my career was centered. But again, it dovetails back to what I was saying earlier, which is the most effective lawyer is the lawyer with the greatest, broadest experience. And we have in California now powerful, powerful laws protecting children. We have to keep low employing them, and we have to keep very directly holding responsible anybody that would not comply, would not report. And that's why your podcast is so important, because it's getting out there the importance of reporting by everybody and anybody that knows anything about child abuse. Even if it's somebody that picks this information up because they see an abused child sitting in a grocery cart in a grocery market, and they can possibly determine that that child may be suffering abuse, report. There's no ramifications against you if you're wrong. But if you're right, you're holding up society. You're protecting a pillar of society. And of course, you should feel very good about helping any child. All of us should feel good about that.
Absolutely. And thank you for paving the way. And I implore people to read your article. I have to dovetail kind of what Michelle said earlier about in the medical profession, how easy it is to basically shop doctors and for a child to potentially go to doctor and not have any kind of consolidation of their medical records.
The important thing, and I think what you're really putting your finger on here, and this is the important thing, whenever, wherever, however, child abuse is perceived by whoever may perceive it, a report must be filed immediately with the social welfare agencies, the child protection agencies, and the police agencies. And it has to be filed in writing. And why do we say it has to be filed in writing? Well, look what happened in the Baby Robeson case. If we hadn't had proof that that police captain police chief had received that report, we would not have been able to get that $600,000 fund put together to protect that child, because part of that fund was underwritten by the municipal authorities on behalf of that derelict police chief. So if you see it, report it. If you perceive it, report it. If you think it happened, report it. Even if you're wrong, report it. We were very lucky to have been given the opportunity to know Baby Robeson and to work from the tragedy of his life to hopefully better the lives of many others.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your time. And thank you for all your kind words. Before we leave today, you should definitely plug Jennifer's documentary, Summer of Soul. Any chance you get, because you're a proud parent.
I'm very proud of my daughter, Jennifer.
Multiple awards.
Jen Isaacson is my daughter. I'm so proud to tell you that she has a number of very important media pieces that are presently being broadcast today as we speak. She was the producer, the executive producer, the key producer of Summer of Soul, which won the Academy Award in 2021. Imagine to be 10 years out of college or 11 years out of college and to win an Academy Award. It's, to me, it's just unimaginable. And I have the pictures to see her there with the award in hand and with the, you know, on the red carpet. I dovetail back to what I said at the beginning. I'm proud of both you, Michelle, and you, Scarlett, because you guys have carved essentially out of nothing an important niche in our sociology, in our crime report. You are both dedicating yourself to an extraordinarily important area, which is to understand criminality, understand terrible crimes, understand motivations, and of course, in today's meeting with me, understand how we can help people, help children.
Well, I just couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. And thank you so much for you taking the time to interview me.